Welcome to the First Beat Sports Podcast. In this episode, we'll look back at some of the highlights from the conversations we've had with our guests over the past 10 episodes. We'll hear from athletic trainers, strength and conditioning coaches, directors of performance, program coordinators, and the coaching staff themselves as they offer their unique perspectives and expert advice on topics ranging from load management and recovery to talent optimization and the practicalities of using data. Over the episode, you'll hear insights from the worlds of basketball, baseball, tennis, soccer, and hockey. So let's get started. Kevin Cronin, head strength and conditioning coach at Colorado College.
And I wanted to touch, I've seen one of your previous presentations, and you posed the question, is it strength and conditioning or conditioning and strength? Kind of, what are you trying to say by that?
So in the context of that, I think I was doing a lecture on like our conditioning system. So we run the 30-15 intermittent fitness test, and then we prescribe training accordingly. And what we have to do on our end is our kids always run before we lift. And that's mainly because of logistics. Like, we have certain spaces on campus that I can book for our teams at a certain time. So like if men's, like example, this afternoon, men's lacrosse starts at 4:45. So we can book space on the turf for us to go out and do our conditioning, do our movement stuff. And then when we're done with that, we can shoot into the weight room. So I was kind of posing the question, like, where does it fall, right? Like, do you hit the weight room and do whatever you need in the weight room and then go out and condition? Because research wise, there's evidence that depending on what you're trying to get out of your conditioning session, you should condition after lifting, but we just can't really do it because we don't have the staff nor the facility to, and I'm using air quotes, like, optimize when we condition. So,
okay. So basically the practical application of kind of the environment that you have is basically kind of what dictates how you're able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Michael Vaughn, director of women's ice hockey operations at Merrimack College.
Kind of looking at the wider picture for the moment, when we're looking at athlete well-being, is pretty hot topic amongst college sports. What kind of protocols do you have in place at Merrimack for the hockey program?
So we use daily wellness questionnaires that players fill out every morning when they get up. And as long as they get that information filled out prior to coming to the rink or the weight room for the day, that's all I'm looking for. And it's short. It's 5 questions. Just kind of looking at, do they sleep okay? Are they eating well? What their soreness level's like? And then a couple more in-depth questions that it doesn't even take them 2 minutes to fill out. And then we also do a session RPE for both practices and for lifts, so that we're able to kind of track, like, if our goal is to have practice difficult level of a 3 out of 5 for a given day, and players come in and be like, well, that was the easiest practice of the year, that was a 1. It's like, all right, well, we missed the mark on that one. So where did we miss it? Was the rest time too long? And it just leads to more conversations. So the more questions we have, the better our conversation, our dialogue becomes.
Do you guys apply the quick recovery test at all?
We do. My favorite time to use it is during winter break, because we're here and there's pretty much no other team outside of men's hockey and then the 2 basketball programs here that are on campus. So there's no classes going on. So players are able to get that, come in. We have the same practice time every day. They show up, we run the QRT, and then from there kind of look at what numbers are like and how things are going. And then depending on the rest of the year, it's a lot is dependent on class schedule. So sometimes we have players running in and out from practice, and it's tough to get that QRT in, but we try and do it at least twice a week. Obviously some things come up and they change, but yeah, we throughout the year, it's at least twice a week. And then winter break, we try and do it every day.
Henry Barrera, director of strength and conditioning for Olympic sports at Liberty University.
And kind of staying on that note with the program, this year basically marks the program's 3rd straight winning season after having 5 losing seasons. Kind of, what do you put that down to?
Oh man. I think one of the things that sticks out is Coach McKay talked about building the program with guys you could lose with first. And I think that sounds crazy. You know, I thought it was crazy when I first heard it. But literally, we have high character guys in our program, you know, guys that really are invested in Liberty University and our basketball program. And it's helping us to continue to build on success. I don't know if people remember, but we lost 13 Division I games in a row our first year. I was worried we wouldn't win another game all year. So that's hard to go through. But we've had guys who've kind of built it. We have a saying in our program, what you do every day is more important than what you do every once in a while. So that's what we try to live by. We'll worry about today and do the best we can. And, you know, good things happen from that.
And so it seems like, I know this is kind of on your background as well, that Coach McKay kind of approached things. This is more team building and leadership instead of, oh, you know, we're going to get the best athletes and this and that out there. And I know, like I said, your approach is a lot about that. So what type of qualities kind of were you looking to bring out in those players?
Man, we talk a lot about pillars of performance. So for us, that entails mindset, sleep, nutrition, training, and readiness. Those are kind of our five pillars. And really what I want with our athletes is I want to prepare them for life. So lifestyle management. If I have guys saying, hey, I want to be elite, well, then let's go. Let's be elite in what we do every single day. You know, so it's really, we're living on a deep level with our guys. You know, we have, you know, real conversations and we're trying to meet them where they're at, but we're also trying to pour into them in a way that is going to be bigger than basketball.
Andy Blitz, athletic trainer for the University of Buffalo men's basketball.
Okay, and do you implement any type of kind of return to play protocol actually using the training load numbers if you do have somebody coming back from injury?
Absolutely. I'm doing it right now. One of my guys tore his ACL at the beginning of the year last year, and he's kind of in the return to phase stage right now. And we're using one of the heartbeat systems to kind of progress him slowly but surely and getting him back into shape. It's great for me to have a number to see what these guys are doing at this time of the year to know what I need to get him to. I don't need to get him to game day numbers at this point because that's not what we're preparing for right now. But I need to get him ready to go for skill work. I need to get him ready to go for the up and down of the summer sessions. And I think having that quantifiable data is reassuring to the athlete who has gone through a long-term injury, but also reassuring to me to know that things are going well.
So it's nice that you have something. Obviously, the eye test is pretty valuable there, and, you know, talking to them about how they feel. But at least you're not going from the old school method of, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, he should be back. Because, you know, at this day and age, sometimes what is it could be that 4 or 5, or it might be the 8 to 10. But now you've got that training load number to help quantify that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, without that, we could do our job. I think that's one of the things I do with the coach as well. I'm like, you're a coach. You know what these guys look like when they're working hard. But having that data to reinforce it and to show the athlete, like, trust me, you have been doing the work. You are ready for this, kind of gives them a little bit more of that trust factor as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. So while we're on the topic of soft tissue injuries, do you actually have any numbers from, you know, the last few years of using First Beat?
Yeah, I do actually. So the first year using First Beat, we were at 103 total injuries. The second year, when we really started focusing on the training load and kind of expanding what we're doing with the First Beat, we dropped our numbers down to 63 total injuries. So we had 40 less injuries this year compared to last year.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. I speak to a lot of different ATs around the country.
Jeff Nivolo, associate head coach for the University of South Carolina women's tennis.
Yeah, can you just get into a bit of how do you use it? I mean, is it day-to-day games, practices, and then kind of the metrics you focus on?
Well, the first thing we realized, to get the whole thing started, we actually do an off-site VO2 max. So we get all the data prior to truly using the First Beat during the season. So we have everybody's correct information going in. I've had people tell me they just plugged in everybody's 220 minus their age. And I'm like, okay, well, that's not going to be any data that you can really use. But and to your credit, First Beat software will adjust once it sees different numbers and everything, which is another great thing that it does. But ultimately, we realized how hard practice was. That was one of the biggest things. So the training impact piece, the 1 to 5 scale, we were having all these practices where we were realizing we're working really hard. We don't need to be running after practice today if the whole team's in a 4, 4.5 scenario. So that was really big. That was the initial thing that brought to our attention. When we do our conditioning, we focus exclusively on the zones. So if we say start in zone 2 and work up to your zone 4, we plug in the First Beat system. It looks crystal clear on a big TV. You create that Orange Theory or group fitness activity type deal for the team. And everybody's getting their individualized workouts and they can see their tile on the screen. So that's huge for us because we're very detail oriented in terms of how we train. And then lastly, it's been huge in avoiding some what I would call catastrophic events in terms of dehydration, overtraining. We are looking at the monitor and somebody looks a little bit off in practice and you see that during warmup they're at 192 beats per minute. They shouldn't be anywhere near there. We could pull them out of practice and ask them a couple questions. And one time we had somebody who was severely dehydrated and was probably a minute or two away from a big time cramping situation, which probably would have pulled her out of practice for a few days afterwards. And luckily we were able to intervene in time because of that technology being present and the data being available at all times.
So you've definitely had some data influence training decisions then.
100%. There's days before a match where we go, gosh, we look, everybody's up in their fourth zone and it's 105 degrees outside here in Columbia. We got to cut this practice. We got to really wrap things up.
Pat Trainer, Tampa Bay Rays minor league strength and conditioning coordinator.
And you brought up 140-plus games in a season. And that really kind of, when I was checking up on you guys in February for spring training, one thing caught my ear was hearing about these travel schedules for some of the affiliate teams. Playing a game, taking an eight-hour bus ride, playing the next morning. Kind of how do you adapt the training programs for these types of schedules?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's one of the many variables that from a physical preparation standpoint and performance standpoint, we have to keep in mind is it's not just about, you know, the workouts and the conditioning sessions and even the games for that matter. There's a lot of variables that come into play when we're talking about player performance and health and longevity. And some of the biggest battles that we have, you know, across the board from our lowest levels, you know, even at the major league level is the travel schedules. You know, you could say, all right, the major league level, maybe they have like charter flights and things like that, but, you know, they're still changing time zones. They're getting in the cities at 4 a.m. and having to bounce back and play the next day. So at every level, you know, that's definitely something that we keep in mind. You know, one of our lower level affiliates in the Midwest League, you know, they have bus rides regularly of 6 to 8 hours. And that's on some of the lower end. So, you know, how we handle everything from times that we go to the park, van times or bus times that the players go to the park, giving them time to sleep in a little bit, you know, how we handle the workloads for that day, both from the physical preparation strength conditioning side and what the field staff do. You know, everybody is very aware across the board of those types of things that are going to affect how that player feels at, you know, come game time. So it's an all-inclusive effort to try to make sure that we do what's best for the player from a developmental standpoint and keep those things in mind and not just say, you know, we're all here, you know, let's just go have at it and grind away, because you know, sometimes that's not the best choice when it comes to those types of things, you know. So it's like I said, it's an all-inclusive effort, and it's definitely something at every single level we have that challenge.
So it seems like there's been a little bit of change in philosophy. It's taken some time, but kind of the old school mentality of, okay, we're going to wake them up at 7, we're going to go to the park, do some hitting and throwing, as to you just mentioned, letting guys sleep in. I think that was something a few years ago, you know, 5-10 years ago, that they wouldn't even consider. Is that kind of how you see it evolving as well too?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. I mean, over the years that I've been, I mean, even coming back with the Rays, we have a really good sports science program that puts a lot of effort into, again, education of all staff and front office involved in those types of decisions that, hey, sometimes getting like an extra hour of sleep is actually a little bit more beneficial. So, you know, during spring training, it's something that maybe having a slightly later start time for the day and maybe just trying to be more efficient with our time during those workouts, meaning that, you know, we may not need these big gaps like an hour in between, say, a game or an hour in between workouts, whereas, okay, if we can get on the field at this time, it's a little bit later, it allows the players to sleep in a little bit later. You know, eventually we're going to get a more finely tuned product essentially on the field when these guys are resting better, eating better, you know, better hydration strategies, you know, all those sorts of things.
Definitely. I think that like makes a lot of sense.
Jen Mavis, assistant coach of UMBC women's soccer.
And as far as the trim numbers that we were talking about, the training load numbers, could you throw me like some numbers as far as like what a game looks like? What is it, you know, maybe a midfielder or a forward for a game?
I just pulled up averages for our spring games, and our center midfielders were putting in an average trim score of about 335. I mean, that's a lot. That's a high score for them. Our forwards are a little bit lighter, just 300. And then our center backs on average were around closer to 275. I think those numbers sometimes change though, right? So it depends on the style of play that you're playing in, and it depends on your opposition. So there were definitely games that I know back in the fall where our center backs were working harder than our forwards were because we were just under the gun, right? We're defending a lot, maybe looking for us to counter out. I think your center midfielders are always going to have a higher score because they're usually boxed to box. They're all over the place for you.
Mm-hmm. Is there a certain number you try to shoot for during the week? If, you know, a lot of teams will say, okay, games are roughly going to be a 300. We've got two games every week, so there's 600 trim points. We've got 1,000 to work with, so that's what we can work with for the three practices.
Yeah, I mean, you just said it. That's exactly what we're looking for. So our head coach is big on periodization. Soccer's got a lot of education on periodization, you know, so working off of the fact that we're going to cost ourselves about 600 trim points on games, she's dividing it out. She's dividing our light training session days. You know, she's probably on average, our moderate training session is, or lighter to moderate training session is about 125. She usually works on that. And at the end of the day, you can think that, you know, if the day, we use colors. So if it's going to be a green day, which is a lighter day, yellow day is going to be a more moderate day, darker orange is going to be a little more heavy or moderate day. And then red is going to be our game days. It's going to be our overload days usually. You know, she's big on that. but you know, you have the dashboard in front of you. You can say, you know, I was trying to go for 125 on the trim score and the elements were just right for us to be too hot. So we either got to back it up because we're watching it in real time, or we'll change what we're doing in the moment, or we're going to end practice a little bit earlier. Or you know what? We thought that this was going to be a harder training session and now we're going to bump this up a little bit and to make it a little bit more intense, change our work to rest ratios a bit.
Benjamin Jensen, First Beat Sports Director of North American Sales and Research.
Well, one thing that makes the First Beat Sports platform kind of special is like the variety and the range of different features and metrics that are available. What would you say is one of maybe the underutilized ones that maybe gets kind of lost in the shuffle that, I mean, maybe isn't the star, but people could start to use to improve their coaching?
Great question there. To be honest, I couldn't name like a single feature. The first three we talk about for people to use is the quick recovery test, the TRIMP, and training effect. I think kind of the next step with a lot of teams, they're doing the balancing act. Either this person needs to trim up a little bit, or most common is they're trying to maintain weight. So the energy expenditure that you can see in real time and of course afterwards gives those coaches the opportunity to help balance that out. That if a strength coach has somebody for a workout, he knows they just burned 500-600 calories. Okay, that means I need you to have this protein shake, you know, this combination of a shake or a bar or something else from the fueling stations. So they go get them to the fueling stations, get them the right amount of calories. So they're always at a zero balance when they leave. So they've done their job. They've done the strength and conditioning, made sure that they've maintained that calorie intake. And so, yeah, I think maybe that would be one. That's kind of one thing about the system is it's pretty simple on the surface. But then, you know, if you really like the data, you know, we've got about 35 different variables that you can export and work with. And so, you know, you want to keep it easy on the surface, go ahead. But if you kind of like to get dirty with statistics, you got those variables to work with.
Mark Egner, William and Mary Field Hockey Associate Coach.
From my experience working with some of the programs, I see communication can really make or break a lot of programs. How do those lines work with not just the field hockey staff, but also with the strength and conditioning staff they're working with the field hockey program at William and Mary?
So this is where our department has made a big move towards what they're calling their high performance model. And we've rolled out an internal load monitoring system that we use within the team based on RPE multiplied by time. And in addition to that, we augment that with our first beat information. So we get an internal load number from first beat, and then we get a perceived load number from the athlete themselves. And then we try to balance the two of those to make sure that we are keeping a realistic picture of the puzzle. With our performance staff, so that's our strength and conditioning, our athletics performance coach and our athletic trainer, and sometimes our sports psychologist, and then our coaching staff, we meet once a week and we talk about each athlete, where they are in their journey, where they are from a physical standpoint, if they have any injuries, what sort of an impact should that have on their ability to participate in strength and conditioning sessions, in practice sessions, all of those things. We have some girls who are returning from serious injuries, who are redshirting, and they have limitations on what they can and can't do in the weight room, how we're managing their training load on the field, how many extra pieces of hockey they can have in their week to replace the fact that they're not participating in games. And we try to work on an individualized level within a team construct. The other thing that we do is we track week to week load on a periodized scale. Our plan had been for our first week of preseason to be no more than 60% of our expected load at the end of the season. So to build slowly rather than to jump right in and overload our athletes in preseason. And that was a new approach that was kind of encouraged due to the NCAA heat acclimatization recommendations, but also just because we were trying to minimize injuries and also make sure that we were ready to peak at this phase of the season. So we targeted October 4th as our first peak point because that was when our conference play started. And that was the day we played JMU and we beat them 7-2. So we were able to kind of look at that and go, okay, so this plan is working. It meant that we had to really reevaluate some of our planning processes as a coaching staff because we were going to have significantly less contact time on the field doing physically demanding work during preseason.
Well, that's good to hear. I love it when I hear the quality over quantity. I think that's what everybody needs to start to hear a lot more. You know, sometimes those double sessions are unavoidable, but if you're able to pull it off with shorter amount of time and still be successful, I think that's a real tribute to the staff and obviously to the whole program, just making things work like that.
Thank you very much. I mean, we went back at the end of our preseason phase and I looked at, we had last year's RPE-based TRIMP. We had last year's first beat-based TRIMP. Because we had first beat rolling for every session last year, we had time for sessions, like contact time on the field. And we were able to see that I think we did somewhere between 40 and 60% less contact work in our first week of preseason this year than we did previously.
Wow.
And it showed, like the decrease in hours was huge, you know, things like that. And then, I mean, we had a really fun exchange with our performance staff here where we were getting ready to play a scrimmage against the team, and we took a photo of the lineups, and looking at it, I said, geez, not a one of our girls is wrapped or worrying about an injury. And I'm looking over at our opponent, who are a very high caliber team, and I think they had 7 or 8 like hamstring and quad wraps and things like that. And it showed in the game. I mean, we were the underdog going into.
Ed Lippi, Senior Performance Advisor for AS Roma.
Okay, and you've spoken previously about the importance of infrastructure, especially in the modern era of pro sports where things can change quickly. What did you mean by that?
Establishing an infrastructure, a framework, is such a critical component to sustain success. What I mean by that is understanding the needs of your athletes and reverse engineering an evidence-based process that will allow them to perform at their best. For us, that meant implementing a screening system that provided us with an athlete-centric roadmap for each individual player, a monitoring system that alerted us to where each player stood on the fitness, freshness, and recovery spectrum, and a daily workflow to keep it all cohesive and repeatable, so we didn't feel as if we were reinventing the wheel every time we walked through the doors of the training facility. I'd just like to make a quick clarification on the term I use, evidence-based, which I think has gotten a bad rap in some circles. For me, evidence-based can mean incorporating the findings of the latest peer-reviewed study on hamstring injuries, but it can also mean using the progressive resistance strength training protocol that has provided you with positive anecdotal evidence for years. So to me, evidence does not necessarily always need to be validated by science, but can be used if it is justified by your own thought process. So as long as you know the why for using it and how it fits into your bigger picture, then I think that for me, that qualifies as evidence-based.
So besides the science, obviously, with the peer-reviewed journal, so it's kind of like the practical application, even going all the way back to, you know, your time with Mike Boyle, the stuff that you used and worked then would still be work now and would be evidence-based because you've used that in the field for so long.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, what we're trying to find the happy medium between practitioner-based experience and, you know, what we're learning from research and some of the objective measures that we get back from the technology that we use. So, yeah, I think it would certainly be silly to discredit the things that we've learned through practice and what we can see with our own eyes day in and day out working with our athletes. That's such an important part of what we do as coaches, is actually working with the athletes and then always monitoring them with their own eyes and identifying what works and what doesn't.
So there's definitely a balancing act there, isn't it? I mean, like you just said, we've got the eye test, what's worked for a long time, and then still got to stay up to date with peer-reviewed journals of what's coming out and what's new.
Absolutely. And I think you've often hear about not just strength and conditioning and performance enhancement, but I think a lot of different disciplines fall into this category where you hear about, you know, the art and science of something. And I think that certainly holds true in our industry, whereas the art of coaching and then the science of coaching, you know, I think we need to be cognizant of both of those elements.
Definitely. So kind of on this same subject, what would you say are kind of the key foundation elements of a successful performance department? Because you've obviously been involved with different departments where you've been at.
By recognizing the importance of complex systems thinking, I think it's one thing to build out the components and add them to your process. It's another thing entirely to understand how each component needs to interact with all the other pieces in your ecosystem to produce successful outcomes. I know this because it's something I think we failed to fully appreciate during my first full season at Roma. We were busy adding this or that, but failed to stop and think about how each piece we added would affect the other pieces that were already in place and or the pieces that we would eventually want to incorporate. This often came down to properly communicating with and managing the expectations of our technical staff.
Okay, and what role actually did the technology play in all of that?
Well, technology has obviously assumed a prominent place at the sports performance table over the last 10 to 15 years. And the screening and monitoring I spoke of earlier can be done with and without technology, but certainly the technology makes it a lot easier to objectify metrics when necessary.
Thanks for listening to the First Beat Sports Podcast. For more information about us and our sports monitoring systems, give us a call at 435-363-9533, or you can send us an email to sports@firstbeat.com. You can also visit us online at www.firstbeat.com. Thanks a lot for listening today, and don't forget to be with us on the next edition of the First Beat Sports Podcast.